This is Master Obi-Wan Kenobi. This message is a warning.
Everyone, hang on!
Carabast. Coffee with Kenobi presents Rebels Reactions.
Let's go get him.
All right, if I tag along?
I'm on my mark. Get down!
My name is Rex.
The rebels of the Lothal system. Hunt them down. My gut tells me this is a trap.
Everywhere we go, we run into those guys.
Kenobi!
To defeat an enemy, you must know them.
I'm not afraid.
That's what worries me.
Embrace your destiny.
We are fighting a bigger fight.
He was my master.
Ahsoka, why did you leave? Do you know what I've become?
Yes, Master.
And now, here's your host, Aaron Harris.
Well, hello there, everybody. Welcome back to Rebels Reactions. I'm your host, Aaron Harris. It is our first episode of the final season of Star Wars Rebels. And we are got a great show to review. They couldn't have started this season off any better. And I have been chomping at the bit to discuss this episode because I saw this 6 months ago at Celebration. So I'm not going to waste any time. This is a great episode. Heroes of Mandalore. And I got an all-star team here to review the episode and discuss it with me. Of course, David Motters is with us. You know David. He's been with us several times before throughout the throughout the run of the show. How you doing, David?
I'm doing good, buddy, and I'm chomping at the bit, too. 6 months, just been waiting to talk about this.
I know. We were sitting next to each other when we saw this at Celebration, so it's going to be a great discussion. And joining us also, a voice you will recognize if you are listening to our other shows on the network, which if you don't, you need to start. Matt Moore from Comics with Kenobi is joining us tonight. Matt, how are you doing?
I am doing so well. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this.
Oh, no, my pleasure. Definitely. I'm glad you're able to join us. I know we finally got to meet face-to-face at Celebration, which was awesome. So
it's great, yeah. I want to thank you publicly for bailing me out like that. I appreciate it.
Well, you know, I figure somebody had to do it. I couldn't just leave you there. Yeah. Disney jail's not fun.
You got a life debt.
You better believe it. Oh, so we got this fantastic episode that they premiered Star Wars Rebels with, this fourth and final season of Rebels, Heroes of Mandalore. Phenomenal episode in a nutshell. We're on Mandalore. Our Rebels are coming to the aid of Sabine's family to rescue her father from Imperial clutches. Things don't go necessarily as planned. There's a big rescue. Then we find out the weapon Sabine designed as she was in the Imperial Academy was not destroyed as she thought it was and came back to haunt her again, as we see this arc-generated electric machine come out and start wiping out the Mandalorians, because it's designed specifically to attack them. And, of course, we have a big battle at the end, of course, which results in the return of this episode. Of course, in this episode also, we have the return of a Clone Wars favorite. Bo-Katan is back, voiced by Katie Sackhoff from Battlestar Galactica fame. Good old Starbucks back. And just an all-around great episode. So let's not hold back. Let's get right into it. Matt, when you first saw this two-part episode, what were your initial reactions?
I was really blown away because Dave Filoni and the crew are setting the bar very high for this final season. I mean, especially when you go from the first episode into the second episode, there was a lot. It was fraught with emotion, and it was just laden with such drama and purpose. Yet there was the perfect amount of comedic relief, I think. But this was a heck of a way to kick off this final season. I mean, it's, to my mind, it's probably among the best Rebels debuts ever. And it just grabs you, you know, by the throat, and the jetpack just launches. And I mean, you are sky high before you know it.
And that we are sky high, just like Ezra is. Unfortunately, we are in control where he was not. It was definitely a great way to start off the series. David, I know I know some of your thoughts on this because we watched it together at Celebration, but now that we got to see the second half of this episode, which they showed us the first half at Celebration, now that we've seen the second half, what are your reactions, your initial reactions to this episode?
Oh, my God, you hit it. Matt said it so well, it just grabs you by the throat. You know, when we ended that first episode at Celebration, I was kind of looking at you, and I was like, well, wait, aren't they going to do two? Because I believe from every Star Wars fan that I heard from that in Anaheim in 2015, they'd shown two episodes, right, to begin season three, I believe. And so we got one. And now, after seeing the second episode and how it begins, I'm like, oh, that's why they did it. They really wanted to leave us on the edge of our seat. And one of the notes I wrote down was, we finally have season four, but also I kind of felt like we have some good news. I've told you this. I've been since 1983, you know, I was 14 years old, saw, you know, Return of the Jedi in the theater, and just loved the high point of how that ended. And with The Force Awakens, Han dying, with Rogue One, all of them dying. I've been worried about Luke here coming up in episode 8 for quite a long time. We lose Carrie Fisher. Obviously, we don't know what they're going to do in episode 8 or 9 with that. And so I've just been like looking for some good news in Star Wars, some heroic stuff. And so the beginning of the second episode, I felt this sense of relief with Sabine's family. And I was like, oh, I had to wait 6 months for that to see what happened. But those are some of my initial thoughts. Two great episodes.
It truly was two great episodes, and definitely understand where you're coming from. There's been a lot of speculation as to, even now, as to what's going to happen with our heroes through the end of the season, and what's going to happen, especially after seeing the way Rogue One ended and everybody dying, and it's just let's not sugarcoat it, they all died. Yeah. Spoiler alert, if you haven't seen it, what are you doing listening to the show? Go watch it, then come back and we'll talk some more. Second thought, this is a Rebel show, not a Rogue One show. So listen, then go watch it. There you go. But definitely there's that speculation and that curiousness as to what's going to happen to our heroes as the season goes along. And definitely from what we see in this episode, it's not going to be easy for them here on out. There's going to be a lot of adversity coming up. Thrawn is still on the hunt. We get to see him in this episode via a hologram. But Thrawn is still on their trail. Just because Bindu helped him get away in the season finale of 3, he's not done, which is what I would expect from Admiral Thrawn. So let's take a look here at the episode, because we get a lot of information in this episode, a lot of background information, not only on Sabine, but we get a lot of history of Mandalore in this episode, since it's centered on Mandalore. The capital city of Sundari is referenced and visited several times, but we get a lot of history when it comes to a lot of the lore of Mandalore, the history of the armor and so forth. It is brought up several times through the episode because the weapon that's being built is directly targeting them. Of course, with your Matt, of course, you are our resident comic expert, and I'm not familiar with comics. I will admit that wholeheartedly. I have probably read maybe. Matter of fact, the only comic series I've read is the Maul series, I will say. So my familiarity with the comics is slim to none. But did any of the lore that they pulled out for when it came to the armor and stuff, has any of that ever been referenced in the comics before, to your knowledge?
To my knowledge, you know, it's been a little bit obtuse, you know, because, you know, you bring in, you know, to what is now Legends, and then, of course, what we now have in the new canon. But, you know, this to my mind, a lot of this was sort of brand new, but it also kind of cemented things that people had always kind of thought that it was. You know, I have to admit, I was really taken aback by the fact that this weapon, and, you know, again, more spoilers, it targets that specific alloy within the Mandalorian armor. But, you know, did not affect whatsoever the, you know, the sort of plastisteel that stormtroopers use. Yeah. And to me, that's just like, that's a big, not a red flag, but just an amazing flag, because now we know the secret, you know, behind this legendary Mandalorian armor and why it's so desired and why it's so sturdy. But it seems to also have sort of a really bad Achilles heel, you know, and that's kind of like, whoa. And you would think that, you would think that, you know, clearly, you know, Mandalore has, you know, this is, you know, it's almost like the Mandalorian equivalent of the Kentucky Fried Chicken recipe kept under lock and key and nobody knows the secret ingredients.
Till Sabine let it out of the box there.
Apparently inadvertently. So much to her horror, because I mean, that was one of the things that, you know, because I was there, you know, at Celebration as well when we saw that first episode and the way it ended on that cliffhanger, and just because you thought, oh my gosh, she's really paid the ultimate price for everything. And of course, thankfully, episode two showed us that it wasn't as you know, it was not as bad as we were initially led to believe, which is a good thing, though. But given the fact that this is Star Wars and it's a Lucasfilm production, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, everything does go full circle and goes very, very pear-shaped for her.
Oh, absolutely. Her story is far from done. I can guarantee that. She's going to have a lot more to deal with going forward.
She is, but that's a really good thing, because in all the years that I've been watching Rebels with my kids, I've always sort of seen Sabine, you know, not so much as like a, you know, yes, she's among the central core of characters, but, you know, to me, it's always been sort of the story of Kanan and Ezra, or Kanan and Hera. And, you know, Sabine has been there and had some crucial roles, but she's never been the focus. And I'm really digging this focus on Sabine and Mandalore, because, I mean, Mandalore is one of those, it's a cultural touchstone for the Star Wars saga. I mean, it's that thing that I remember being 13 years old and debating, you know, in my classroom with my best mates about, well, you know, Boba Fett's a one of a kind. No, he's not. They're all there. There's a lot of them that just haven't found him yet. We just don't see them. Well, you know, see, and now we know. Now we've seen them. You know, of course, you know, we saw them in the Clone Wars, but now we're getting that deeper dive into the sort of history of Mandalore.
And a deep dive it is, going into Mandalore and into their history there, because the armor themselves, they even say it's a special armor. It's got that special alloy in it, but it's also a lot of emotional attachment to their armor, because their armor is, they of course, say it's passed down generation to generation. Sabine even said at one point in this episode that her armor is 500 years old. She's just modified it to fit her and her personality.
That's amazing. I mean, that's on a level of the Jedi Order.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, with this adherence tradition.
Oh, absolutely. It's definitely something that obviously plays a huge role in their culture. And we've always known they've had a deep-rooted tradition in their culture from all the episodes we saw of Mandalore during the Clone Wars, with the Duchess and Death Watch, and everything that happened there. We saw there was that deep-rooted historical significance to their tradition that they didn't want to let go of. And we're learning more of that here in Rebels. David, what were your thoughts on all this Mandalorian lore and history coming out?
Oh, I was just taking it all in. In fact, you know, I was trying to figure out, you know, comparing the Clone Wars and those episodes. In fact, I grabbed it while we were talking, the Clone Wars episode guide, and I had finished up season five, and at the end there it has those episodes with the Mandalorians, and I was looking at what planets are they on, but they're on Zanbar is one of them. Just looking here through the guide, but are they, when Maul takes over the throne, is he in Sundari, the capital? Is that, because I'm looking at All of the you know, the Lawless, Shades of Reason, all these, this huge, you know, arc that they did where Satine is killed and Obi-Wan sees it, and I'm looking and I don't see Sundari anywhere mentioned here. It just mentions Mandalore, but I didn't know if you guys knew that. That was one of my questions, you know, because they show the capital city, and just like you guys, I'm trying to put this all together in my head from those episodes and this. There's so much, but I think that I'm starting to get it organized in my head, particularly when I listen very closely to all the different clans. And I think something, what was it? Fen Rao says, what is it? The protectors are with you as well. You know, I was trying to figure out where do they fit in. So there are all these different groups, and it sounds like they're all united now, but it's just fascinating to me. I love it. Kind of like Matt said, it's a cultural touchstone. And for me, I'm eating it all up and trying to really, I think, get it organized in my head, truly.
I definitely can understand that. There's a lot to wrap your head around in what they've shared and what they're showing. To answer your question, I don't think in the Clone Wars, and if you know 100% for sure, Matt, feel free to jump in. I don't think they ever really mentioned that the city that Satine was in was Sundari. But I do believe that's where it was. I do believe that's where she was. And that it was the capital of Mandalore. So I would assume that's where the Duchess Satine would have had her palace throne, or where her seat of power would have been.
Yeah.
I would have to agree with you on that one.
Yeah. So. Everything I see here, you know, it's written by Jason Fry. It has, you know, the first five seasons, but it just mentions Mandalore as I look. Nothing specifically, you know, city-wise. It does show that Pre Vizsla has his outpost on the planet of Zanbar, but that was just briefly before they go and attack Jabba the Hutt and all that stuff. But yeah, I would agree with you. Yeah, I think it's all consistent there with being at Sundari and stuff. But a lot to take in.
It is, and we see a lot of, and I know, David, you brought up the clans. We see a lot of the clans united there at the end of the episode. We see, of course, they mentioned Clan Ren, which was already there. Clan Vizsla was there. Clan Kreets, which was Bo-Katan and Satine's clan. All the clans coming together to unite finally under the leadership of Bo-Katan to eventually lead a war against the Empire and fight for their planet's independence. So definitely, it's going to be a fun route. I don't know if we'll get to see more of the Mandalorian struggle during Rebels as it winds down. Considering we're already two episodes of the 15 in at this point. I don't know how much more Mandalore we'll get to see, but definitely I hope they continue to explore.
Yeah, I think given the way it ended, I think we will probably, you know, maybe see some return to Mandalore or some elements of what happened in these first two episodes through the course of the final series.
It would be nice.
Final season, I should say. I'm sorry. Yeah.
Well, I definitely hope so. I mean, this is going to be, it's a big storyline, and Sabine is a fan favorite for folks. So they want to know what's going to happen to her, what's going to happen to her family, because even though she did pass the saber to Bo-Katan to lead, she's still got a pretty heavy role to play in Mandalore. Bo-Katan even tells her it's time to show your people where your loyalties lie. And before they
wasn't that great? I mean, it's a great way to end episode two. I mean, I loved how, you know, Bo-Katan comes back to the base camp, and, you know, there's the clans Eldar, Rook, Kreez, Vizsla, and Ren, and they're just awaiting her. And then, you know, that was a big moment, I think, for Sabine to give Bo-Katan the Darksaber and to have Bo-Katan finally accept it and accept this mantle of leadership. in such a trying time, because you know they realize that war has come, and that it it's not going to be easy. But then again, for a Mandalorian, I think that's the state of conflict is almost the state that they sort of want to be in. Given their very, very warrior-like aspirations.
Exactly. And for all of you that have listened in the past, here comes my my Star Trek reference for the day. Very much like Klingons. They're very warlike. They like their battles. That is for sure. No more Star Trek references tonight, I promise. So,
oh no, bring it on. I don't mind at all.
I just always wind up getting one into every episode. I don't know why. It just always happens. I always get one reference in every episode. So
Starfleet forever, yo.
I got a chopper reference for Aaron later. I always try to get a chopper one in on Aaron. So
hey,
just to tease him. I'll share it later.
Yeah. Yeah, my buddy is back, man. I was so happy when I saw him on that screen again. I tell you, Chopper's in there, and he's, did have a bigger role in this episode or either of these episodes as being in the mix. I mean, Hera was only in there via hologram once or twice, so we didn't see much of Hera in this. Of course, she was off planet. No mention of Zeb at all in this episode either. So then, they're off with the rebellion at this point, working, still fighting, getting that organized and going.
I think that's okay though, because I think that's I think we're going to have sort of this long lingering goodbye to all the characters, whether or not no matter what their fates may be.
Exactly.
And I like that notion of them doing it like this.
Oh no, absolutely! It's a good way to do it, because it helps wrap stories, focus in on one or two characters and show their growth. I mean, let's talk about Sabine for a little bit, because Sabine, from the time we first saw her in season one till what we saw in this episode, that character's had so much growth over these four seasons that has really transformed the character and defined her. I mean, when we first saw her in season one, she was very much, you could tell she was what I would almost define as a troubled teenager. She was quiet. She knew what she liked. She knew what she was good at, but she didn't give anybody much time for anything. Especially Ezra. She was very, had no time for Ezra. But he grew on her. But we get to see her grow and take more responsibility and get more step forward in taking more leadership, especially when it comes once she got the Darksaber, her entire persona and level of responsibility completely changed. What do you think of the development of Sabine over these seasons, David?
Oh my gosh, you were hitting it. I told you the other night, or tweeted it or direct messaged it to you that I was watching. I thought what I would do is watch the season premieres of the first three seasons. And it was interesting to see all the characters in the first season, the second, and the third, just how they began. I didn't watch season finales. I just thought, well, let me just watch the season premieres and watching that, the first episode where she's got the spray paint and she sprays it inside the Star Destroyer and Kallus is like, run, and it just blows up, and and she's having fun with all the colors and the paint, and she's like, oh man, I can't see it. And Kanan says, no, it's beautiful as always. And just like you said, very much a troubled teen. And then looking at her in this episode, one of the things they do is they do have Fenn Rau and Bo-Katan have a talk to really, in essence, they did exposition to convey that growth to us. They're both impressed with her. And you even see that point where, she's looking at all the clans and she's, stands forward and says, hey, I'll take responsibility for this. And even talks about, why it happened, being irresponsible, even what she named the, what is it called? The arc pulse generator, even the name that she called it, the Duchess, was, from being young and inexperienced and not clear-headed on things. But I think, like anything, why would we be interested in somebody? And I think it's these girls, and the storytelling that Dave Filoni and these guys do is incredible. So yeah, it comes full circle here for her, and so much growth in her, and I care about her as a character. And one of the things that you have gotten me hooked on, Aaron, consistent with the question you asked me, is Kevin Kiner's music. And I go back to the Trials of the Darksaber when, you know, she's learning to use that with Kanan's training, and they play that music in the violin, and I'm just in tears. And then, you know, I'm a 48-year-old grown man, and I'm in tears. And then watching this, and Kevin Kiner's got that violin just subtly playing in both of these episodes, and I'm feeling the feels again, and I'm getting tears in my eyes, and I just think I'm listening to that stuff so much more. But the musical cues for her and her growth and the emotion involved with her, you know, like I said, I care about her, not just because of the art, the music, everything. And so it's been a really neat progression over 4 years for her.
Absolutely. It's been a great progression for her. And don't get me started on Kiner, man. We'll go all night on that.
Oh, no.
I'll tell you, there's a pecking order when it comes to music music. And I tell you, they've done perfect with Kevin Kiner, because my pecking order goes John Williams, then Kevin Kiner, because the guy is just masterful in every little piece he's done, and is constantly on the edge with these episodes, and it definitely helps. I mean, the storytelling and the artistry alone, and the performance of the voice actors draw you in, but the music ices the cake for you emotionally and to each episode. So. So yeah, I mean, get me all sidetracked on Kevin Kiner now. I'll go on for an hour.
Well, even Aaron, the sound cue. You know, if listeners to this podcast go, you know, and you and I always reference it, the episode guide, the sound cue. I hit that, and there it is. It's the music for Sabine, and I'm telling you, between that music for Sabine and the music, the orchestra he got together to do the music when Ahsoka walks off of the Jedi Temple there, away from Anakin. Oh my gosh, he just is literally using musical strings to tug at my heartstrings. Just incredible.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It's mind blowing how he does that. Let's get back to Sabine here before I go off on Kiner, because I will. But Sabine, I mean, you brought up some interesting points with Sabine, because she has had that growth, and the music definitely enhanced her story. But we see a lot of who Sabine is in this episode. Of course, we saw her mom last season, and her mom was very, you know, very strict. She was the warrior. So obviously everybody speculated at that point Sabine gets her artistic feel from her dad. And we see her dad, Ulrich Wren, in this episode as he gets rescued in a very Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade-esque raid on some transports there. Very, very enjoyable. And we meet Ulrich, and we find out that he's more of he's more like Sabine than everybody else I would have expected. He's more of the artist. Being a dad, Matt, what did you think of how they portrayed the father-daughter relationship there?
I thought it was good, because, I mean, you know, I have to admit, I was one of those people, you know, I was always under the assumption that, you know, given what we saw with Satine in the Clone Wars, and then, of course, you know, with Sabine taking hold of the Darksaber, that it was a very matriarchal led society. Not to say that the men were cast aside, because clearly they weren't. It's, you know, they're very equal, especially when it comes to being warriors. But I love the notion that her father had such this. Is it wrong to say almost sort of the subtle influence upon Sabine? You know, melding sort of like the best of both worlds, you know, with the ability to, you know, get the leadership that she got from her mother, as well as, you know, sort of the ability from her father to soften the blade of leadership, to be more in touch with her human side, if you will, or her Mandalorian side, you know, so that she could, you know, lead properly and, you know, and with care and context.
Exactly.
And that to me was driven home by the portrayal of her father.
No, definitely. Exactly. I agree with that. And I mean, we see that a lot in even in their interactions and conversation. I mean, we see that immediately when we meet Alderic. He's strapped in and chained up inside the troop transport. And when Sabine blasts that paint bomb on the front of the transport, and the guy can't see, and he just looks up and goes, "Pink, it's Sabine." You know, he knows his daughter just by the color of paint that's being splashed around at this point. So he's had definitely a bigger impact, and she had a huge impact on him as well, as most little girls do on their father. I know my little girls got me wrapped around their finger, so I can only imagine that Ulrich's being definitely wrapped with Sabine. So, and definitely, I'm sure he had some difficulty with the history that she had, because we learned more about her, Sabine's trip to the academy. I mean, we know she was in the Imperial Academy. We know she was there experiencing her training and everything, and we've learned from Trials of the Dark Saber and everything that her history with building weapons, and the one weapon she built that she was afraid would be used against her people, and that's why she could never go home. And it led to this huge emotional moment, which was absolutely tear-jerking and very moving. And then we find out what she did. We find out about the Duchess, which is the name of what they call this arc electric generator weapon that's drawn to the armor. It showed me two things. It showed me, one, how we always knew Sabine was smart with the weapons, very weapon savvy. This just showed how genius she truly was and is, because she was able to take, design a weapon that pinpointed a single element in their armor and caused the destruction of, and that could just cause the destruction of entire people. I mean, that's not something necessarily to brag about, but it takes genius to do something like that. And so I can definitely, it definitely shows me a different side of her and makes me understand her more in her emotions there, as she is battling that, why she battled with her emotions to even go back once she got the saber. And even more so at the end of the first part, when she thinks that the weapon killed her parents or killed her mom and her brother, Tristan, I mean, and Ursula. So it definitely brought even more tension to the episode. For both of y'all, what were y'all thoughts when this started playing out, when we found out more about this weapon and we started seeing how things played out, and we see her, especially the emotional strain of when she thinks her mom is gone? What were your thoughts at that? Because I mean, that's how we ended at Celebration, thinking her mom was dead, her brother was dead. So I know how I felt when I walked out of that theater, but now knowing that they're not. But what were your initial thoughts on that?
It was devastating. I mean, because, you know, just, you know, even though it's animation, just the look on her face and the realization that she had a hand in the creation of something that struck at those closest to her, at her own blood, you know, and that, you know, how, you know, I left that viewing thinking, you know, how this is going to weigh upon her. This is going to drag her low and destroy her. She's going to be consumed by guilt, and rightfully so. I mean, you know, clearly it was not intentional, but, you know, it showed, it hit home very hard that, you know, your actions, you know, forever, you know, your actions have consequences. And I think at no point throughout, you know, the first three seasons was that, you know, made so readily apparent than the look, you know, when we saw that look on her face when she was like, oh my gosh, my, you know, my mother, my brother, they're dead. Everyone's dead. It's my fault. And of course, you know, that's that huge heaving sigh of relief, you know, in episode two. Like, yeah. Okay. But then, of course, you know, clearly, I mean, I at least I knew my perception was from watching the first 3 or 4 minutes of episode two that, all right, she now knows her path to redemption is set. Her redemption arc is now in full effect. Yeah. And she has to not just own up to the fact, you know, that she had a role in the creation of this weapon, but she has to solve the problem forcefully and resolutely.
And not only solve the problem, she has to face the people that think she betrayed them by doing so.
Yeah, she's got to make it right. And of course she does. Clear that, you know, by the end of episode two, it's very clear that, you know, I don't want to say it's redemption, but she is definitely well on the path toward redemption, I think. I mean, I clearly there's going to be a lot of distrust toward her that will linger, and rightfully so. Among the people of Mandalore.
Oh, definitely. And I agree with that. And there is some distrust there. I mean, we see that immediately once they disembark from the craft that rescued them from the onslaught of stormtroopers after the weapon was used. They arrive back at their base camp, and some of Bo-Katan's troops come out and identify her, and they draw their weapons. They're ready to execute her right then and there. And if it wasn't for Bo-Katan, there probably would have been a shootout at the OK Corral style right there between the Wrens and the House Kreets. I never could say that name during the Clone Wars. I don't know why I'm trying it now. So... She was always the Duchess and Satine to me. But
you're doing great, buddy. Like hand in hand, right? You know, it's so all these Star Wars names are tough. Some of them are really tough to pronounce.
They do come up with some unique ones, that's for sure. But House, I'm not even going to try it again. But they definitely have some things to work through. And Sabine definitely has a lot to prove as she goes forward. And we see her work toward that. And even at the end of the episode, when she's in her, as you would say, her redemption, in the midst of her redemption at that point, she's face to face with her weapon. Kanan and Chopper have cleared the databases so that can't be rebuilt, wiped all the plans out of there, but I'm sure they're still on Scarif somewhere. The plans were wiped out of that Star Destroyer that they were being kept on, and she's standing there in front of the generator, and she has reprogrammed it to attack stormtroopers. In just a few clicks of a button, we see her genius come out again, and in a few clicks of a button, she has reprogrammed the machine, and it's now attacking the stormtroopers. It's attacking Tiber Saxon, who took over after Gar Saxon was killed last season. It was Gar Saxon's brother, I believe they said he was. So, I mean, we see that genius come through, and if it wasn't for Bo-Katan stepping up and telling her and stopping her and convincing her this is not the right path to take, we would have seen a completely different ending of the story, because I honestly hardly believe Sabine would have cranked that baby up to full power and watched every one of those troopers fry. So Bo-Katan played a major role. Even though she wasn't in it, she was in it for a good part of the show. Not a lot of lines, but she played a huge part in Sabine's redemption story at this point. David, jump in. Help me out here. Yeah. I had a question lined up, and it just completely left my brain.
No, I was going to jump right in there. I know you always do such a good job of setting us up, me and Matt. I'm just thinking about a couple of things. In the episode guide, it talked about the evolution of the story and how they did have Bo-Katan play that voice of reason, that exact part that you were talking about, Aaron, where she's ready to crank it up. And you know, It's interesting to hear Bo-Katan use two words, fear or hope. And of course, hope is always that word we've been hearing since 1977. And yeah, she plays that critical role in the storyline of being the voice of reason. And then, boy, that's the person you want to lead, right? You know, a strong leader, but also has good critical thinking skills. And so, yeah, that was a critical part. And, you know, something I was thinking about a few minutes ago that Matt had said was, you know, just talking about how it's like all these clans seem to be happy to be at war. Like you mentioned, the Star Trek reference. And, yep. You know, and one of the things they talked about as well in that episode, God, is they've aged Bo-Katan, at least they tried to a bit. They're approximately 18 years older than what we see her in the Clone Wars. And so, thinking about what both you and Matt said, I just think about her, Bo-Katan, being at war. Not just when we see her in the Clone Wars and all those battles we saw there, but for, you know, another 18 years and we see her here. I mean, that's a lot of wear and tear. That's a lot of hopefully learning for her, but definitely. And then you can see with Sabine, you know, she's even more resolute in offering it right a second time to the Darksaber to Bo-Katan. So yeah, it's she's this critical role, and it is really neat to see her come back after, I guess, 18 years, right? 18 years of war for her, or more.
Yeah, exactly. 18 years is a long time to be in the position that she was in. I mean, we know she was considered, after a lot of people, they could say in the episode, a lot of people consider her the rightful leader after her sister was killed by Maul. Then the Imperials took over. She was was in charge for a while till the Imperials took over and the Saxon clan undermined her authority and basically drove her away. Saxons have been running the show since. It's definitely a unique feel for the episode. So far we've had, there's so much to cover in this episode. They've jammed so much into it. Of course we got a great, it was good seeing Finn Rao in action again. The Protector was there. So it was good to see him in action. So definitely we have a great feel for what's going on with Bo-Katan as she, her history has definitely been a rocky to say the least. Which made for definitely an interesting story for her. I mean, definitely she was a fan favorite back in the Clone Wars, even though she was kind of there as a bad guy for the longest time, but definitely she started seeing her redemption after Satine was killed, and she's been on quite the journey. Well, let's take a look, though, right now at some of the influences in this episode. Because, like I said, we've seen a lot of Mandalorian influences being put into play from some of the designs they built from the Clone Wars for Sindiri to all the armor we see in one shot there at the end. All the different clans, I believe we referred to it earlier. We see all the clans together pledging their loyalty to Katan and to Sabine, and that's when Sabine passes the saber over. And Andy Gutierrez during Rebels Recon even says that in that shot of all those armor, that in that shot, there are more armored Mandalorians than in any other shot, period, in Star Wars, period, history. All of it, which is quite interesting and quite enjoyable, considering we'd had long stretches on Mandalore during the Clone Wars. So we get to see a lot of history and a lot of different designs, too, in their armor. Very intricate, very different designs, very colorful, some of it more subtle than others. So what did you think seeing? I know, Matt, you're a comic guy, so you are used to looking at all the art going into the comics. What were your thoughts of seeing all those different designed armors just jammed into that one shot. All the work that they had to do just for that one shot in and of itself.
I thought it was an amazing proliferation of color and design work because, you know, for so long, the only real shots we ever had of Mandalorian armor was Jango Fett and then of course, Boba Fett. Well, Boba Fett, then Jango Fett, if you want to go in the release of the films. But and then, of course, you know, during the Clone Wars, it seemed a lot of that was sort of it was all similar without really breaking a whole lot of ground. But then, of course, when we were exposed to Sabine's I don't mean that in a negative way at all, but just her uniquely designed and painted armor was just this furious burst of color. And then to see it, the way we saw at the end of episode two, with this design work was just astounding. And it's cool because it would make sense because if you look at our modern non-fictional history, like the Scottish clans, for example, or the various houses across European royalty or across Asia, under the Khanate or even among the African kingdoms, everyone has always had their own unique style and design to perpetuate their personal beliefs and then their mythology. So it makes perfect sense that we would have this on Mandalore if you have all these different clans, because they are going to be true to themselves while at the same time forming this cohesive bond for all of Mandalore. And it's a great way to, have this splash of personal identity amongst all this uniformity.
Plus it looked really pretty.
It was very pretty. Oh, well said, Matt. Well said. Definitely. It was
Thank you.
Well said. It definitely made the episode even more appeasing to the eyes because they always do a phenomenal job animating these episodes. And they are always top notch. I've yet to see an episode of Rebels, or even going back to Clone Wars, that was not well animated. So they definitely did have the top, some of the best in the industry, obviously. Let's take a look real quick, though, because we're running close on time there, at the Empire, because we have a new leader of Imperial leader of Mandalore, Tiber Saxon, who's Gar Saxon's brother, and
he's a peach.
Oh, he is, isn't he? putting it mildly, he has a unique outlook on how things should go compared to obviously to how Saxon, Gar Saxon, his brother, used to think. And we even see Thrawn call him out on it. Because he's just focused on presenting this weapon that will destroy Mandalore, essentially. Mandalorian warrior without his armor is just a warrior. In other words, we're no big deal at that point if we don't have our armor, which is a very cold statement considering, how much tradition we discussed earlier is locked into those armor. David, what were your impressions of good old Tiber there?
Yeah, just like Matt said, what a piece. I thought I didn't like Gar Saxon from last season, and Tiber comes along, and I'm like, wow, this mom must be proud, whoever the mom is of Gar and Tiber. Wow, what a crew. Can you imagine those two growing up? Oh, my God. The house is destroyed, right? They're both like 8 and 10, and they're already destroyed the house, literally. One of the things you'd mentioned a few minutes ago, Aaron, was the issue of influences. And one of the things you hear Tiber talking about quite a bit is the Emperor. The Emperor has shown me the true way and all this. And you wonder how much he's been there talking to him or through hologram feed and stuff and talking to this guy and just working his brain over. And you see Captain Hark, he's the guy, he's the one trying to be the voice of reason to Tiber, and he's the Mandalorian who's saying, well, what if the Empire, you know, gets this machine and uses it against us? And Tiber would hear none of it. He did not want to hear any of it. And you could tell he was completely, at least in my view, if I'm wrong, you guys tell me, but completely brainwashed, completely worked over by, you know, the ultimate Dark Lord of the Sith, the Emperor. And like I said, you hear Tiber mention the Emperor several times. So he's already a peach, but then he's also got the Emperor filling his ear with a bunch of bad stuff as well.
Well, I think it's a clear case of Palpatine finding a willing adherent who wants to hear, wants to be told what they want to hear, much like, you know, Anakin, much like he did with Anakin, you know, much like he did with Darth Vader. And I think it's a testament to Thrawn. You know, Thrawn gets this reputation as sort of a know-it-all who has no faults. Although I disagree, I think in this new iteration of Thrawn, he's more, for lack of a better word, human. But, you know, I like the fact that, you know, whereas, you know, Tiber is talking about, well, yes, you know, Mandalore will rally to the Empire now with this weapon, you know, and Thrawn's like, I'm not so sure. I think we may have just, you know, this weapon will probably have the reverse effect and be a clarion call for resistance to the Empire, because there's going to be a lot of people on Mandalore who are going to realize, well, what's to stop them from turning it upon us if we're no longer filling a need for them?
Exactly right. And I'm going to throw a monkey wrench in this real quick, and based on something that David said, because we do see Tiber refer to the Emperor several times. But let's be honest. Do you really think Palpatine actually cared who was running Mandalore as long as they just did what he wanted? Do we really think he actually took the time to try to influence this guy? Or was this guy just like some of the people we see nowadays that are just influenced by what he saw on the Holovids?
Oh, he's definitely an opportunist.
So
he's taking advantage of the situation. Oh, they're both everyone involved in this aspect, they're all opportunists. They're basically trying to get their piece of the pie and steal the rest of the pie so nobody else can have it. You know, it's that old chestnut. You know, is it absolute power that corrupts, or is it just that the corruptible are drawn to absolute power?
Exactly. And he's definitely corrupt. He's that's beyond reason. He's a few screws loose up there, and hopefully that little jolt of electricity that he got there at the end woke him up to reason before he got fried when the Star Destroyer exploded. We're pretty sure he doesn't walk away from that. If he does, I'd be impressed.
Well, but to kind of respond to like what you're saying here, and I do think about what you're saying, did the Emperor talk to him or not? You know, I think about, you know, we talked about it this summer, going through the Thrawn book, that, you know, here, you know, when you read that novel, you can see that, you know, do I think that he is worked over or influenced by the Emperor? Not really. He's got that independent thought, and he's got another plan, obviously. You know, Thrawn does. This guy, Lord Tiber Saxon, you know, the sense I get is that, yes, first and foremost, he's an opportunist, but at the same time, you wonder if, again, you know, Palpatine has always thrived on chaos. When there's chaos, that's when he rose to power, right? Get two different sides fighting, and it seems like, I don't know, maybe this is my view, that he worked this guy not just only to create chaos, but to convince this guy to go against the Mandalorians, where all these other people weren't necessarily that much against the Mandalorians. Like I said, even Captain Hark is saying to the guy, look, you know, that you got to think about us too. And he's not even thinking about Mandalorians, but, I don't know, maybe Palpatine whispered in his ear, maybe not, but, he's not good either way, this Tiber guy.
Well, no, I'm not saying Palpatine didn't whisper in his ear. I mean, I just don't think it was a, they met face to face, there's that type of influence. I'm sure probably Palpatine doesn't even know this guy's name at this point. It was probably he just watched him give speech after speech after speech, either when he was addressing the Senate, he probably got the Star Wars equivalent of C-SPAN and watched every speech that that Palpatine gave and kind of latched onto that, those teaching, and latched onto those speeches as teachings, and used that to progress his agenda, which at that point, once his brother died, it was taking over Mandalore and making Mandalore submit to the Empire. Not because that's what he was told to do by Palpatine, but what he probably felt was the best thing for Mandalore at that point. And I think in a weird, warped sense of duty, he thought he was doing what was right for Mandalore.
Yeah, no, understood. Good point.
I can see that point, and that, you know, and that's an astute observation. But there's just part of me that I can't help. I can't shake the notion that the deeper pull for him is that what he's going to get out of this. It's almost like perhaps he's camouflaging his own naked ambition by saying it's about Mandalore and not the man. But I think in this case, it's clearly about the man and not Mandalore.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Mandalore is just a vessel for him to get to where he needs to be.
Oh, no, and I agree with you there, because he even says at one point when Captain Harka is talking to him, trying to be the voice of reason, he even says, "I am the Empire." Nobody says that. Palpatine's the Empire. He says, "I am the Empire." They're going to submit. I mean, what did Vader call it in Rogue One? Aspirations. He has aspirations of grandeur ahead of him that he's never going to reach because he's, made the wrong person mad. And Sabine let him know that.
Mm-hmm.
So, overall, definitely a great episode. There's a lot of little nods to other movies and stuff throughout the series. I'm curious to see if y'all caught them all in this. Of course, we mentioned at the beginning the chase to rescue Alren, very reminiscent of Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade there. Of course, the jetpack, of course, the whole Rocketeer reference there, which I thoroughly enjoy because Rocketeer was a phenomenal movie from the 90s, which, again, if you haven't seen it, you need to go see. But did you catch any other references? I'm curious. Matt?
Well, the Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade being the most obvious, and, of course, like you said, the Rocketeer, I that just really jumped out at me. So just to the point that I was kind of expecting, there's going to be a biplane or a sport plane somewhere flying around there in a few minutes. But
from now on, when they go system to system, it's just going to be a map with a red line,
Well, and, one of the notions I got was sort of just almost like this, homage, to, the Godfather, with Bo-Katan, taking the reins of power. It's a bit of a stretch, I think, but that kind of reminded me of that in a sense, when Al Pacino's character sort of, assumes control of the family, and charts the course for the future, that kind of stood out to me.
Very good. David?
I think for me, like you guys mentioned, the different movie references, one thing that stood out to me was an homage from Rebels back to Clone Wars. And I was just mentioning a few minutes ago, that great arc where, Palpatine takes out Savage Opress and then, does the lightning bolts on Maul and says he has other plans for him. In that episode, I remember the door opening and Bo-Katan is standing next to Obi-Wan and there's just all this war on Mandalore. And I think she says something like, "Boy, Maul must want you dead." And Obi-Wan's like, "You have no idea." And if you guys remember that,
Yes, I do.
Just a great visual. And in this one, you see the clip of Ezra And he goes inside the Star Destroyer, and it opens up, and he's kind of looking up, and they're just, you know, Mandalorians and Imperial Super Commandos, you know, with jetpacks flying around. And he kind of had the same look on his face as when the door opened for Obi-Wan. That episode was The Lawless back in season 5. I'm looking at some of the pictures from it. And I really thought that, I don't know, maybe Dave Filoni would say, no, it's not. But it really seemed like this episode was doing an homage back to that Mandalorian episode. So that's kind of a something that I picked up on that I thought might be kind of cool to talk about.
Yeah, that's good. I missed that one. I like that. Now that you mentioned it, I'm sitting there going, how did I miss that? But yeah, those are that's a good one. I like that. I don't know if I know what David's going to say on this, what his answer is be, but I don't know about you, Matt. I don't know if y'all do video games or anything like that. But at the end of the scene where they rescue Ulrich, when all of those transports are going off the cliff, and you see Ezra jumping pretty much from transport to transport to transport as everything's falling before he finally reaches the ledge and is just kind of hanging there. To me, that was kind of a nod and a throwback. There was a game, I can't even remember which one it was. It was one of the Uncharted games that came out. God, it was either Uncharted 3, I want to say it was Uncharted 3, I believe it was. And it opens up with the hero, Drake, on a train. And it winds up going off a bridge, and he winds up having to go car to car to car, almost exactly like that, to survive. So to me, that was kind of very reminiscent, because I remember having to hit those X's and the joystick and just trying to make it up there. Thinking, watching Ezra do it, I'm like, man, where's my controller? I could get him up there faster. But definitely, it was a great episode. A lot of great nods in it, and definitely a lot of fun things that happen. And definitely, if this episode is an indication of how the rest of our season is going to go, buckle up, folks. It's going to be a roller coaster.
That's a good thing. That's a very good thing.
Dave said it best at Celebration when he made the announcement. He goes, it's going to have to end. I want to end it on my terms. And he is definitely making that happen. And I'm interested in see how this ends, because once the season's over and we see how Dave wanted it to end, makes me go back and scratch my head. If he had the opportunity, how would he have gone through and ended the Clone Wars if he ended it on his terms? So, gives us a lot to think about.
Well, one of the things I was looking at, Aaron, was, like you said, how will it end? And I know on the Coffee with Kenobi Network, we try to really keep speculation down. But I do think, you know, something that you and I have talked about before on previous podcasts is, you know, I very much would love it to end at the Battle of Scarif. You know, we see the ghost flying in Rogue One, and we hear General Syndulla's name mentioned. We do obviously see Chopper, your favorite guy. It'd be really neat for it to end there. And I know I'm looking ahead. We don't have a lot of episodes this season, but it'd be neat, I would think, if it ended there. Just as a thought.
I can see why there would be a push to have it sort of coincide with the events of Rogue One. But part of me wants to see these characters go their own separate ways. I mean, you know, we get the impression that, you know, Hera Syndulla is, you know, she's a general in the rebellion. You know, we know this from Rogue One, obviously. You know, we see the ghost at the Battle of Scarif. You know, we never see the ghost leave the Battle of Scarif. that's always up in the air. But, you know, I kind of get the notion that perhaps maybe Sabine returns to Mandalore to help Bo-Katan fight the Empire there. And it just, you know, kind of leaves these stories open. And of course, I mean, we all know that Ezra becomes Snoke. I'm kidding. It's a joke. Okay.
I thought he was DJ in the Han Solo story. Last Jedi. I thought he was the DJ guy. But hey, you never know.
Dark Jedi.
Yep. Oh, I love it.
You know, if that actually turns out to be the case, there's going to be a meltdown in a lot of theaters on the Thursday, December 14th.
So, oh, you better believe it.
Twitter will explode. Spoilers be damned.
Exactly. David, I see now David will start getting a text from me. You're not going to believe it.
No.
We'll know there's truth to that rumor if for some reason Dave Filoni says, I'm taking a Twitter break, you know, the week that The Last Jedi makes its debut.
Oh, gosh.
That's true.
Yeah, his last tweet will be, it's true, all of it.
I don't know. I mean, this is obviously we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but I would just kind of like, you know, their fates to be nebulous. You know, to sort of kind of leave us hanging and leave us in suspense, you know, to, you know, maybe set something up for later. Who knows?
I like that, Matt. Kind of like Ahsoka at the end of season two, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
And I think by the end of it all, we will be very happy. We will be sad that it's over, but we'll be happy with how they end it. So we want it to come. We want it to see how it ends, but we don't want it to be over. So,
I'm just enjoying the ride.
Exactly. That's all we can do is enjoy the ride. So, Heroes of Mandalore, great episode. Final thoughts, David. We'll start with you. What are your final thoughts of Heroes of Mandalore after our discussion tonight?
Oh my gosh, enjoyed it. Finally got some closure. On what we saw 6 months ago and back in April. It was really neat to see that play out. One of the things I did before we got on the air tonight is I went to StarWars.com and watched the season 4 trailer number 2 again. And that's where Ezra starts off speaking, you know, Loth Rat, Loth Cat, Loth Wolf Run, pick a path and all is done. And then as you get to the end of it, you hear Ezra say, all the paths are coming together, right? And then you hear Kanan say, I'm just not sure we're going to like where they lead. Again, making me nervous as we, you know, get done with these first two episodes and look forward. I'm hoping that we have some upbeat, fun times this season. This is my final thoughts. I really enjoyed this. It was exciting, fun. The action's incredible. Watching Ezra shoot his jetpack and fly through the debris of a TIE fighter, it's incredible. And just all the visuals that we got to see. But I'm hoping that, kind of going back to that season 4 trailer, I'm a little nervous. I've always said that. I'm a little nervous about where it's going to end. But I'm excited for this season, and it's going to be a ride.
That it's definitely going to be a wild. It's going to be Mr. Toad's wild ride, or actually Mr. Filoni's wild ride, let's say. Matt, what are your final thoughts on Heroes of Mandalore?
I thought it was a great way to start this final season. It had a lot of emotional heft. It broke a lot of new ground, and it set the stage for strings of story to come back around and be retied as we advance ever onward to the what will ultimately be a satisfying conclusion.
Very good. Very good. I agree. I look at this episode and definitely it was probably one of the best season premieres that we've had. I thoroughly enjoyed it. You said that earlier, Matt. It was phenomenal. It was action-packed. It was edge of your seat. It was gut-wrenching at times. You felt your heart break and you pieced back together. It was one giant Splash Mountain ride at Disney. It's all it was. It was all over the place, and it definitely made for a very enjoyable episode. There's definitely some comedy in there to break it up, or else this would have been so. Can you imagine if we didn't have what little bit of comedy was in there to try to break things up? Like Ezra when the speeder bike got destroyed, and they they're kind of laying there, and Ezra's mom or Sabine's mom's like, "Are you okay?" And he's like, "Better than the bike," as it's burning and exploding into pieces. I mean, just little things like that that just broke up the intense nature of the episode, because there was it was a very heavy. I mean, without those, it was a heavy episode, but it was been even deeper and even heavier at that point. A lot of fun stuff to walk away with. A lot of history of Mandalore. A lot of interesting looks at Sabine. Of course, Bo-Katan was back. Chopper's back, guys. It was great all the way around. Definitely, I enjoyed it. When it comes to grading the episode, overall, we do like grading the episodes. I'm going to have to, even though I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed it, and I thought it was a phenomenal episode, very deep, I'm still going to have to give her an A-. There's some things, it was phenomenal. I thoroughly enjoyed it. But it was to me, the measuring stick for Rebels has been Twilight of the Apprentice and Twin Suns. Those are the measuring sticks. It's not those. It's up there with it, that's for sure. But definitely a good solid A-. Matt, how about you? How would you grade the episode?
Oh, I give it a very solid A. Just because, you know, I will always hold in reserve an A+ for something that's truly, truly astonishing. And this episode, these two episodes were astonishing. But just a little bit more and they would have been truly. So solid A.
Very good. And David, how about you, my friend?
Yeah, you've heard me before on this show. Twilight of the Apprentice is, you know, the season finale there of season two was, again, for me, that's the A+, like Matt said, truly astonishing. So I was definitely thinking A-, right in that range. Not a B, because it's clearly better than episodes that have been that. Incredible, incredible shows, both of these, animation, story, etc. But still not as good as Twilight of the Apprentice, in my opinion. And my Chopper thing, Aaron, to tease you, is I don't know if you saw Rebels Recon, but Chopper got briefly replaced.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
I didn't know if you were upset, but, you know, the screen went blank, and I think, let's just say Chopper rectified the situation. So Chopper's back. Chopper's back.
Oh, yes. That was quite, I did thoroughly enjoy that. He did not hesitate. He went straight in for that bump. He was going to bump that droid out of his spot. I enjoyed that.
We're good. I had to do my Chopper reference for you.
Today. Of course. It wouldn't be an episode without, everybody knows Chopper's my man. So, or my droid, I should say. Chopper is the one I love. Definitely, it has been a great night, guys, talking with you guys, reviewing Heroes of Mandalore. If people want to continue to talk Star Wars with you, or just reach out and ask you some questions on get your thoughts and pick your brain, what would be the best way to do that, Matt?
Well, you can always follow me, at least for Star Wars comics, on the Comics with Kenobi Twitter feed, which is Comics with Kenobi, but there's no I in the with, character spaces. You can also listen to me on a couple of other podcasts. I co-host Comic Book Noob with Scott Murray and Regina Davis, and we do that every couple of weeks through the Assembly of Geeks. We take a look at comic book characters that have made the leap from the printed page to TV and or films and other media as well. And then I'm also I've just started joining the Krypton podcast, which is going to be focusing on the 2018 TV show Krypton. And we're diving into the history of that world and its mythological foundation for the Superman creation, if you will. And then, of course, you can find me individually on the Twitters at Gorilla Scribe. And it's just so we're clear, it's not gorilla like the simian, but gorilla like the rebels. So that's a Gorilla Scribe, which is GUERRILLASCRIBE. So it's two R's and two L's, the way it should be spelled.
And we will make sure it's spelled correctly in the show notes, Matt. No worries.
Well, there's a debate as to whether or not there should be one R or two R's, and I always hew to the fact that it should be two R's. So
There we go. All that matters is what you think, isn't it?
Well, provided that it's correct.
See, the proper response at that point was said, I'm thinking it's correct. All good. David, how about you, my friend?
You know, at this point, Aaron, it's always, you know, there's that person who's on five different podcasts and, you know, like mad, and he's starting more and he's got, you know, and then I come on and I got the real simple one. I just have one podcast, Rebels Reactions with you. But mine is real simple. It's on Twitter, at David_Motters. And the last name is M-O-D-D as in David, E-R-S. So that's where I am.
Perfect. Perfect. And definitely we want to hear your thoughts on Heroes of Mandalore. So don't hesitate to let us know. Of course, you can email us at rebelsreactions@coffeewithkenobi.com. Or, of course, hit us up on Twitter at Rebels Reactions. Of course, if you want to talk to me personally, of course, the easiest way to do that is via Twitter at TAHarris121079, or email me, aharris@coffeewithkenobi.com. Definitely, we'd love to hear from you and get your thoughts and just chit-chat about Star Wars anytime. I'm always game for talking the wars. So, and if you're lucky, I may even throw a Star Trek reference in there for you. So, definitely check it out. Hit us up. And if definitely make sure you're hitting up the rest of the Coffee with Kenobi shows. Of course, Comics with Kenobi for all your comic needs. Of course, the flagship show, Coffee with Kenobi with Dan Z. We have Lattes with Leia. Legends Library. We got some of the best shows out there, so check them all out and enjoy. Thank you, everybody, for listening tonight. Matt, David, thank you so much for joining me. It's always a pleasure to talk to you both, and I'm glad you were able to join me and review such a tremendous start to a tremendous season.
I'm glad we were able to make it so.
Definitely.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks for having us on here.
No, my pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us, guys. Thank you, everybody, for listening. We got a great season ahead, so just buckle up and enjoy the ride. It's going to be one crazy season, folks. It's going to be great as we roll our way to the final the series finale. So, thank you, everybody, for listening. Remember, this is the podcast you're looking for.
Well, kid, you pulled it off.
Was there ever any doubt?
Yes.
Chopper, get us out of here!
If you would like to respond to our question of the show, have a comment, or just want to say hello, send us an email or MP3 at feedback@coffeewithkenobi.com. Or if you have a specific question or comment for either of us individually, email us at danz@coffeewithkenobi.com or coreyc@coffeewithkenobi.com or visit us at coffeewithkenobi.com and click on the Contact Us section or comment on one of the stories featured on the site. If you enjoy the show, please write a review in iTunes or Stitcher. You can also like the show on Facebook at facebook.com/coffeewithkenobi as well as keep up to date at our Twitter feed @coffeewithkenobi. You can also find us on Tumblr at coffeewithkenobi.tumblr.com. If you enjoy the jazz music, the album is Eye to Eye by Steve Torak.
This is Spectre 1. I need a lift.
This podcast is not endorsed by the Walt Disney Company or Lucasfilm Limited. It is intended for entertainment and informational purposes only. The official Star Wars website can be found at www.starwars.com. Star Wars, all names, sounds, and any other Star Wars related items are registered trademarks and or copyrights of Disney and their respective trademark and copyright holders. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Coffee with Kenobi unless otherwise indicated.
This is the podcast you're looking for.
There's no one here. Move along. Move along.